Technology Access Rights of State and Local Government Employees with Disabilities, Part 2, by Stephen Mendelson. Editor's note, the first part of this article was published in the spring 2016, B.C. Undue hardship. But perhaps the most important part of the decision is the way the appeals court treats the undue hardship defense advanced by the county and relied upon without analysis or question, quote, as a matter of law, close quote, by the district court. The heart of the county's argument was that making MC-311 accessible would cost too much. In explaining why the district court had been wrong, the appeals court began by citing the improper way it had credited the county's expert's cost estimate while rejecting the plaintiff's equally qualified expert's much lower estimate. Apart from the county's expert's opinion, which was no better than the defense's expert's, there was no evidence to support the existence of these high accessibility maintenance and upkeep costs. The battle of the experts was not appropriate for resolution at summary judgment. But that wasn't the only error in the district court's treatment of the undue hardship defense. Quote, the district court focused almost exclusively on the cost of the accommodations without regard to other statutory factors, close quote. The district court had not considered the number of employees working on MC-311, including the software engineers, who said they weren't too busy to deal with it under their existing time commitments. Thus, there was a dispute as to how much, if at all, additional personnel cost the county would incur from making MC-311 accessible. But most important, in determining whether making MC-311 accessible would be an undue financial hardship to the county, the district court had ignored, quote, the considerable savings the county realized from creating a centralized call center in the amount of $10 million, close quote. In this connection, the appeals court went on to note that the district court had relied on an irrelevant factor. Quote, the district court also relied on an irrelevant factor, the county's budget for reasonable accommodations, in assessing undue hardship. The county had argued that the cost of accessibility would vastly exceed its budget for reasonable accommodations, parentheses, the first $500 to be paid for by the employee's department, and remaining costs from a $15,000 line item in the county's overall budget, close parentheses. Quote, allowing the county to prevail on its undue hardship defense based on its own budgeting decisions would effectively cede the legal determination on this issue to the employer that allegedly failed to accommodate an employee with a disability in the first place. Taken to its logical extreme, the employer could budget $0 for reasonable accommodations and thereby always avoid liability. The county's overall budget, $3.73 billion in fiscal year 2010, and MC-311's operating budget, about $4 million, are relevant factors. But the county's line item budget for reasonable accommodations is not. Quote, in effect, the district court reduced a multi-factor analysis to a single factor. That is, cost that the court believed was simply too much for the county to bear. But while cost is important, it cannot be viewed in isolation. Rather, it is the relative cost, along with other factors, that matters. Close quote. A template for future cases. This appeals court analysis provides an excellent template for use by other courts and by workers with disabilities in responding to undue hardship defenses in technology access cases. After this decision, any court deciding that technology accessibility is too expensive acts arbitrarily if it does not explain how it reached that conclusion and what other factors besides dollar cost it took into account. After this decision, workers seeking accessibility can ask the court, parentheses, can plausibly and rightfully demand to know, through pre-trial discovery or otherwise, close parentheses, what significance the court assigns to the fact that the agencies implement new technology because of the cost savings or productivity gains expected to result. How much money the employer expects the underlying inaccessible technology to save becomes as important as how much accessibility will cost, and the amount in savings or productivity gains expected will usually be a lot more. No longer, if the reasoning of this decision is followed by other courts, will public employees be able to argue that the savings and benefits from major information technology upgrades should be disregarded in determining how much spending on accessibility is appropriate. Until the improbable day when an agency comes into court with the argument that it didn't intend to save any money or achieve any productivity gains through its major technology upgrade, the benefits of technology and the costs of access cannot be separated one from another. In the wake of this decision, relative cost and benefit emerge as the dynamic elements of a sound decisional process. calculating the numbers. There is another key element of the undue hardship issue, but one that was not discussed by the court. It is the one that also has great bearing on how undue hardship claims will be decided in the future. That issue is whether the county's admitted failure to consider accessibility from the onset in the procurement and the implementation of the system is in itself a violation of the law, as failure to install a ramp at the entrance to a new county building would be. According to the way the appeals court approached the case, the question of the county's legal obligation, if any, to design in accessibility from the start was not up for decision. Nevertheless, because of the significance of the issue in our ever more technology-dependent work world, and because of the number of people who will be affected by the answer, the legal question of whether accessibility should have been included in the first place cries out for our attention. From the standpoint of undue financial hardship, the cost of making MC 311 accessible will surely be higher as a retrofit or after-the-fact add-on than it would have been as an integral element from the original design. From a functional standpoint, too, retrofits are rarely as effective as integrated design. Thus, whatever the total amount the court eventually decides the retrofit will cost, incorporating accessibility into the system at the design stage would almost certainly have proved much less expensive and far more effective. In evaluating an undue hardship claim, one key legal question is, therefore, which figure, the cost of retrofitting or the cost of timely incorporation, should be used. If the county continues to litigate this case after February's powerful jury verdict against it, it will probably continue to argue undue hardship based on the cost of retrofitting. In fact, there are already reports that it is upgrading MC 311 once again without accessibility. If this county, or any state or county, is permitted to include the extra costs of accessibility attributable to belated implementation, thereby inflating the costs of accessibility over what they would have been incurred in a timely manner, the county will be rewarded for its flagrant indifference and incompetence. If allowed to include the entire cost of retrofitting in the cost of accessibility, rather than only what accessibility would have cost if built in from the beginning, governments would be allowed to use a cost figure that, because higher than it needed to have been, increases the possibility that undue hardship will be found to exist. Public entities should not be permitted to engage in this sort of gamesmanship. They should not be permitted to forego accessibility in system design on a bet that no one will later require retrofits at a much higher cost. Only the costs of accessibility at the design and contract stage should permissibly be taken into account in evaluating an undue financial hardship defense. Otherwise, whether the county's undue hardship defense prevails or not, its indifference to the law goes completely unpunished, and there is no incentive for it to act responsibly when doing so could have made the greatest difference. Put in equal opportunity terms, and paraphrasing the question posed in Reyazuddin's Court of Appeals brief, should an employer be allowed to configure its workplace in a manner that, quote, screens out, close quote, people with disabilities, then when it gets caught, be allowed to argue that the costs of making up for it or for its dereliction are too high? By failing to hold the county responsible for screening people out through inaccessible design, the courts would be answering this question with an emphatic yes. They would be saying that employers are permitted to configure their technology in a predictably and inevitably exclusionary manner and then take budgetary refuge against the consequences of their negligence. The arguments already made by the county in seeking to justify its behavior make this risk clearer. Seeking to bolster the county's position, the trial court had noted that county officials, when designing the system, had no way of knowing a blind person would attempt to use it. But why should that matter? Would a county be permitted to forego installing accessible entrances in a new administration building because no wheelchair users were known to be employed at the time the building was designed? No. Far from bolstering the defendant's case, the county official's plea of ignorance, if taken seriously, would make exclusion permanent and irreparable. Meaningful work. The county's attempt to avoid the accessibility problem by reassigning the employee to another job also underscores the inadequacy of traditional forms of reasonable accommodations in technology settings. The job to which Reyazuddin was reassigned did not entail full-time work, yet she was expected to be at work full-time. Because she was subjected to no loss of salary or benefits, the county believed its accommodation was reasonable. Under the circumstances, the county probably regarded itself as benevolent for doing this. And probably, no matter what work could or couldn't be found for this employee, the county had no intention of firing her, even if it meant paying her indefinitely for doing little or nothing except showing up. This only highlights the dilemma. It doesn't solve it. Loyalty, sentimentality, pity, or make-work jobs aside, there simply aren't going to be positions to which people excluded from their customary work by the introduction of inaccessible technology can be meaningfully reassigned. In the modern office environment, indeed in almost any contemporary work setting, there aren't going to be many jobs that people unable to access the information technology can perform, or that will allow them to build skills and careers, or that will enable them to retain self-respect and the respect of their colleagues. Unless the law addresses technology accessibility head-on, and until government at all levels recognizes that in an increasing number of instances, accessibility is not one possible accommodation, but the only reasonable accommodation, the paradoxical problem of dwindling opportunity will only grow worse. Make-work jobs that seek to evade anti-discrimination laws at the cost of disregarding the dignity of work and of workers can only delay the reckoning for a little while. Like the federal government, states and localities must understand that without ICT accessibility, their commitment to enhancing the number and the quality of job and career opportunities for people with all disabilities will prove hollow, if not hypocritical.